Glad to see at least a good portion of you came back. This is called the quiet hour for us speakers, you know, because usually it's when most of them go to sleep after lunch. But anyway, one of the books I've enjoyed reading had to do with mountain climbing, written by Dr. J. Strack. I can't remember the name of it all of a sudden. But he states that on the way to the top of the highest peak in the French Alps, there's a small inn. This inn provides rest and respite for mountain climbers. It is called the Mediocre Inn, which in French, oddly it's French, but anyway, simply means halfway. Imagine coming off a day climbing in the city, climbing in the icy, windy French Alps, says experienced climber Dr. J. Strack. The cold has seeped into your bones. You're exhausted and every muscle in your body hurts. At the Mediocre Inn, you find a hot meal and a warm bed. You begin to relax, put your feet up, and get comfortable. Who wouldn't like that? But success is not found in rest and comfort. Success, reaching the top of the mountain, requires going back out into the cold and wind. It requires stretching and straining and working towards a goal. Dr. Strack says about 80% of the climbers never go any farther than the Mediocre Inn. Once they've had a taste or had a day or two of rest and comfort, they turn around and descend the mountain, never reaching the Alps' highest peak. They lose the determination to reach their final goal. It's so easy to lose that interest, that drive, that reach when you get to the halfway point. And that's what we find with Nehemiah. He was cupbearer to the king of Persia. And this put him in a high position of power, because he tasted the food, most of you know, and he tasted the drink before the king did. And you got to have a guy that you trust. You got to treat him well, okay? Because one day he may not taste the food and let you taste it, and it's all over with. So he was a man of high influence, and in a sense, it was a very powerful position. There's several things about Nehemiah that impressed me, but this one impresses me maybe as much as any of them. That is, Nehemiah's concern was for God's reputation and God's city, and he'd never been there. He didn't grow up in Jerusalem. Had never seen it, scholars tell us. There doesn't seem to be any indication that he ever seen it in the text. But he was concerned about God's reputation. He didn't just grieve over the city. He prayed over a city he'd never been to, never seen, but he knew it was God's city. And in that day and time in antiquity, the walls of a city represented the power of your God, the authority of your God, the prestige of your God. In the case of Jerusalem, it was God's place of presence. Of course, we know God is everywhere. But he told everybody that this is where he would dwell, in the city and, of course, in the temple. And when the walls were torn down and the city was destroyed and the temple was destroyed, it was as much as if it told the world that Jehovah God is through. Now, if you remember back in the days of Rahab and the spies, and when they were out into the land of Canaan spying out the land before Moses would bring the Israelites into the land of Canaan, and Rahab said she had heard about Jehovah God, hadn't read in the scripture, hadn't read the old law or the of Moses or what have you, but she'd heard about Jehovah God, how powerful he was, and how he'd conquered Egypt and all that, and the Egyptian army. But now, people are saying, he is no more. He's weak, if he even exists at all. He can't do anything for his people. He's a lost cause. Jehovah God is done. He's through. He's kaput. Nehemiah knew that, but the thing that's unique is he'd never been to Jerusalem. He'd never seen the city, yet he was concerned about God's reputation. It's estimated that over 3 million people were taken into captivity and were living in captivity at the time Nehemiah wrote this book. As far as we know, when the first group was going back by Zerubbabel and eventually Ezra, About 50,000 Jews went back to Jerusalem. That's it. Out of 3 million who lived in captivity and became accustomed to it, maybe even enjoyed it. They had no desire to go back. Only 50,000 out of 3 million had no desire to go back to the city, had no desire to worry about the city anymore. They were having children, grandchildren now in Babylon and Persia and all that stuff. And so they're comfortable. And so there was no concern. Here's this man in a high position that says, I am deeply concerned about God and his reputation. I'm deeply concerned about how people see his power and authority. And he didn't just grieve about it, he prayed. And if you'll notice the first chapter, how he prayed, I won't get into all that, I won't have time. But if you read chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, he prayed not only for Jerusalem and for the city and for the people of Israel, but he prayed that God would forgive them, and he put himself in the same boat with them. As if he had committed the sin they had committed. As if he had done the wrongs they had done. If he'd been as evil as they had been. But he went ahead and put himself in the same condition. He said, pray for me. I'm part of Israel. That's who I am. He hadn't committed those sins. He wasn't responsible for what Israel had done. But he said, I'm part of that family. Please forgive me. You might call that ownership. Call it whatever you want to. That's a sign of a good relational leader. He stays with his people. He deals with things as if he's with the people. And he is willing to pay the price with the people. So the neglected walls revealed a nation in decay. And it had been that way for such a long time now that nobody really cared anymore. The nations around Israel at that time, mostly Arabian, just mocked the God of Israel, joked about it, and really didn't have much respect for it. But this man Nehemiah did. He shows in chapter 2 what a leader must do. First of all, see the need. Nobody else saw it. Now, we realize Ezra was a part of going back, and so was Zerubbabel, and he was the governor and all that. But nobody really saw much as far as the walls, the rubble around the city. They were willing to go back and institute the law of Moses again, and the sacrifices, and the temple, all that. But you see, the walls of the city represented symbolically the power of the God. The walls of the city represented the defenses against the heathens out there. And the city of Babylon, for instance, one of the most powerful nations of its time, and very, very wealthy. The opulence of the city of Babylon was just overwhelming. They had walls 6 feet thick, and they represented the world's finest in power and wealth and decadence. Nobody conquered the walls of Babylon. They went under them. You remember the story. Darius, king of the Medes, working with Cyrus, king of the Persians, dried up the great river Euphrates and walked in under the walls and conquered Babylon. But nobody was concerned about it. They didn't see a need, evidently. It's just, you know, what are you concerned about? They're just walls. Nehemiah says, but they represent something. They represent a city half-built. They represent a God who doesn't have a power anymore. They are not respected by the peoples around the area. The God is just powerless because the walls aren't up. So he saw the need. He cared about the need. He knew where to take the need first. Why is it we pray after things have gotten in disarray? Why is it we prayed after we've already developed the plan and want God to simply rubber stamp it? I mean, we've done that. I know we've done it. I've done it. And more we're learning as an eldership, before you develop a plan, ask God to give you the strength and wisdom to develop a plan, to make sure it's within his will, make sure it's what God wants. There's a lot of things we'd like to do, and we get excited about different plans and ministries and programs and all that kind of stuff. That's okay. But let's pray about it first. If we have a need over here and we want to get a program or ministry going, let's pray about it first. Ask God to guide us and direct us. I know we think we're pretty smart and creative and all that, and we probably are. But how do we know God's going to bless it? And so he was a man. Here's a man who saw the need, he cared about the need, and he knew where to take the need first. This is a visionary leader, as opposed to a leader who just puts out fires, takes care of the status quo, okay? Reactionary leader. And so prayer is not a last resort. It should be where we go first. Nehemiah sets the stage. That's why I say the book of Nehemiah is one of the greatest textbooks for biblical leadership you'll find anywhere in the Bible. Lays it out. Shows the example of what a godly leader should be. So God honors Nehemiah's plan and prayer. We see in the second chapter, he takes it before the king. King respects Nehemiah. You better respect your cupbearer, shouldn't you? And so he lays out a plan. He already prayed about. And notice that God honors order, 1 Corinthians 14:40. He doesn't honor disorder. That doesn't mean that order and organization are the end result, more important than anything else, but they are important. It was important in Acts 6 that the apostles, who were actually, I think, fulfilling the role of shepherds and elders, it was important that they put people in charge of the Grecian widows, which were not being taken care of. A little prejudice going on there, you suppose? Got a problem? Got some fires developing there? Here's a church, probably somewhere in the stage of 5 to 10,000. I hear different stories, but somewhere in that size group, okay. Maybe closer to 10,000, I don't know. And they got Grecian widows and they got Jewish widows. But the Grecian widows aren't being taken care of. They're being ignored. A little prejudice going on there, see? Some things carried over from the old Jewish mindset and thinking. And so they kind of ignored the Greek widows, the Gentile widows, and their needs. So the apostles are looking at it, say, we got a problem here. And so they responded to it and had a plan, and they got organized, and they did something about it. And they did something that would solve the problem for years to come. God honors order. Nehemiah gave the king a definite time. God honors a prayer of faith, James 1:5-8. Gave them a specific time. Gave the king a specific time, told him exactly what he wanted to do. Talked to the king about resources and all that. That's all good stuff. Jesus said something about don't be foolish as a builder, right? Don't build it on sand. Be faithful in what you do and make a plan and build it on something that's solid. That's a plan that's built within the will of God. And God honors a prayer of faith. So Nehemiah's plan was a good plan. God honors planning, Luke 14. Count the cost. Nehemiah pointed out the need. Now he's talking to the people he wants to follow him. He identified with the need. He included God in the need. And he didn't say, I'll be in my office if you need me. Okay? It's so easy to say, okay, this needs to be done. Some of you get with it, will you? I'm an elder. I'm a preacher. I don't have to dirty myself. I mean, I don't say that, but, you know, I mean, is that kind of what we're saying? We don't want to get involved in it. I'll be in my office if you need me. Again, that's what a visionary leader does. Handling opposition. It is best to learn from criticism. At times, criticism should be ignored. But there are times when criticism is pretty accurate. In fact, there have been some studies done on this. And the studies reflect that in most cases, now get this, in most cases, criticism is either partially or completely accurate. It's the attitude that's probably the problem. And our tendency is to overreact. You see, if I'm a positional leader, I don't take criticism well. I have to protect the position. And so I'm defensive as a positional leader. I can't take criticism. And so my tendency then will be as a positional leader to come back and attack the critic, put him down, isolate him, ostracize him, whatever it takes to shut him up, because there's no way he could be right. I'm an elder. He doesn't have the Bible knowledge I have. I'm a preacher. He doesn't have the experience I have. What happened? But you see, as a relational leader, that doesn't make any sense. If you're going to have a relationship with that person, you don't put them down. You don't belittle them. You don't stigmatize them, ostracize them. Okay? You sit down and you spend time talking to them. And I've already given you an example of that, what we try to do at our congregation. If you got a criticism, let's sit down and talk about it. I don't need to react to it. I don't have to defend my position. I just have to listen to you and try to meet what your need is. And if it is a want that doesn't have any basis in Scripture and reality, it's just a self-centered want, then we'll deal with that. But I've got to listen first and not react. If I'm in a defensive mode, I'm going to react first. That's one of the basics in communication, both in the church and in families and in marriages. If I'm afraid of anybody who will criticize me, if I'm afraid of anybody who thinks differently than I do, then I'm not going to communicate very well. And I'm not going to do a very good job of shepherding, am I? And, you know, one of the qualifications of a shepherd was to be self-controlled. That's sometimes tough, isn't it? When some brother or sister makes you angry. We'll talk about that in the communication process. Nehemiah persisted in the truth. He knew what he was doing was the will of God. Had to be. And undoubtedly in his prayer, he sensed that, you know, if it's not God's will, he's going to let me know somehow. But he sensed from his prayer that it must have been approved by God. And then as he continued with the plan, he saw God's unfolding approval of this plan. You didn't go to a king of Persia, the most powerful nation in the world at that time, and start talking to him about him doing something to help you fulfill a plan. You just didn't do that. I don't care if you are the cupbearer. You don't go before a king like that. That's dangerous. You lose your head. It was not appropriate. So he knows at this point that when the king accepts and listens to him, is willing to support him, God's there. He's behind it. I'm going to give you an example of what's happening with us in the Seattle area. When I moved up there, there were probably a handful, maybe 13 churches in the Tacoma, Seattle area. At that time, Seattle was about 600,000. Now that whole area, Tacoma, Seattle complex, is about 3 million people population. We've doubled in churches. We have about 30, 35 in that area. Still not a lot, but up until about 15 years ago, we had a strong fellowship. Sure, we have a few that are off the rails, but we had a pretty strong fellowship, doctrinally and biblically. But in the last 15 years, we've just lost that togetherness. We've just lost that fellowship. And we had a workshop years ago. It was along the lines of Tulsa. In fact, it began really around the same time Tulsa began their workshop. And there were times we'd have over 2,000 or 3,000 people at our workshop there in Tacoma. And then because people were squabbling about some things, and some of the leaders after I left didn't handle it very well, I think, began to die. So about 2 months ago, I got together with our elders and talked about us resurrecting that same workshop again. And I said, if you'll commit $5,000 to it, I'll go talk to another eldership that we have a real strong relationship with that are very biblical sound. And so they said, yes, we'll commit $5,000 to it. That's a pretty good commitment for a congregation of 160 members. So we went and met with the other eldership we've had a good relationship with, and they said, yes, we'll commit $5,000 to it. I thought, well, we're off to a good start. So I called several of the preachers in the area. I knew that the disagreements we had were not so much in real strong biblical doctrinal areas. And some of the areas were probably more opinion, whatever. So I started calling the ones that I knew were agreeing with me. When you start out with a program, call the guys that agree with you first, guys, okay? Now that's just good wisdom, see? Wise as serpents and harmless as doves, as Jesus said. They were all excited about it. So then I started calling some guys I didn't agree with. But I knew they weren't off the rails. I mean, you know, we can still fellowship them. Before I knew it, we had over 10 churches involved, and we're close to raising $20,000. And this has only been within a three-month period for this workshop. And most of the people involved now were not here back in the early 80s when we had the workshop. They're telling me there is a hunger for this. We want to get back to a good, solid workshop that's biblically sound. It's not radical to the left or radical to the right. It's not legalistic or liberal. It just teaches good, sound, biblical principles with good speakers. And we want to meet together and enjoy the singing. When we did it before with 3,000 people there, there's a hunger, because I was making the point, churches are weakening and dying in the Puget Sound area. Now, I know it's not happening down in L.A., but it is up there in Seattle, say. When that happened, I said, you know, I think the Lord's behind this. And my wife said, she always corrects me. You ever have a wife like that? And the trouble with it is, she's always right, see. She said, you probably should have known that a month ago, 2 months ago. It's exciting. I'm excited about it. Now we're on board, and so we're going to have it at a major Lutheran university there. Nice campus, beautiful place, and the excitement is building. And I'm thinking, you know, when God's behind it, I didn't think it could happen before, but when God's behind it, there is no end to what can be done. You've just to have a vision that you know is in tune with God's will. And if that's the case, you can do anything you want to do if you know God's behind it. There's nothing we can't do if God is behind it. I'm going to go to preaching here in a moment, but and we've gotten away from that, brother. We have not had the faith we should have had long time ago. You can do anything in this area. Money is not a problem. You know, I start off with this idea. I say, well, maybe we can get the 10,000 from the two churches, but I don't know about anybody else. They're going to jump on board. It's going to be a tough job. Oh, faithless me. I had to call, make a few calls, and I talked to the preachers, had a meeting with the preachers, and next thing I let them do the work. Next thing I know, we're up to $20,000 and we're still growing. We're past what our budget was that I had thought we'd have to have this workshop. Money is not the problem. We've got to get away from this idea of thinking money is the issue and let money dictate what we can do. Let money dictate what we can trust God to do. I could spend a bit of time on that one. But anyway, he persisted in the truth. At times, criticism should be ignored, but sometimes you have to listen to it and see whether or not it's right. What most people need is not more help, but more hope. And that was what was happening in the Seattle-Tacoma area. Talking to young people. Somebody asked me today, why are young people leaving the church? Because they have no hope. What do you mean by that? They see dead churches or churches that are dying. They see leadership that's not operating on faith and that's not visionary, and because of that, they're losing hope. They see families, moms and dads, that aren't visionary, aren't faithful, aren't involved and engaged, and because of that, they're losing hope. That's why they're leaving our churches, folks. It's not because you don't have the best youth minister in the world, okay? It's not because you don't have a real effective youth ministry. That's not the problem. The problem is we have leadership that doesn't have faith in the Lord, and we have parents that don't have faith and a commitment to his church. That's the problem. And that's got to be changed. Because somewhere down the road, we'll be out of tune with God. He'll rise up a nation or a people. We'll be doing the job we should be doing. I was down at Sunset a couple of years ago. I go down there from time to time, teach and do things. I teach in their master's program and what have you. And I was talking to a missionary in Africa. And he said, you know, we used to joke about missionaries and going into Africa and all that, and that someday maybe they'd be coming up to America. He said it's already happening. We have missionaries from South America and missionaries from Africa now coming to America. It's already happening. I don't know if any of you know Charles Cook. He's from the Central California area, and I've known him for many years. His daughter-in-law used to be my secretary there at Davis Park, and I was down there talking to him one time. He just came back from China. He's the one that started the school of preaching in Singapore. It was doing great. Now, you all probably know that the church in China is illegal. They're underground. They're house churches. And when they started the school of preaching for Sunset there in Singapore, he had people coming to him left and right when he started the school. Then his wife got ill, and after 2 or 3 years, he had to leave. But he said before he left, he gathered all the students together and some of the people and families of the students. They knew he was leaving. They loved him. Charles is a great guy. And he said, I told him that I'll pray for you because I hate to leave you, and I know how you struggle in these house churches in a country and a nation that's persecuting you and won't allow the church to be legal. He says, I know what you're struggling with, and I will be praying for you. I love you. And And one of them, he said, raised his hand and stopped him right there. He said, no. He said, we're fine. He said, we're going to be praying for you. Because you're going back to a nation that's ungodly and a church that's so weak, they're losing their emphasis on what it means to be a Christian. Let that one soak in for a moment, folks. What they were saying was, it's easier to be persecuted, live underground in house churches. We have a stronger binding fellowship. It's easier to worship God and be faithful in that condition, in that situation, in that nation, than it is in America, where you have all the freedoms to be whatever you want to be, and the church can do whatever it wants to do. That's a powerful statement, folks. That condemns us, doesn't it? We need more Nehemiahs. Jump up and say, we can't allow this any longer. We've got to step out and do something that we know will help the church to grow and be the kind of people we're supposed to be. All right. Dealing with discouragement. In chapter 4, they're at the halfway point. You know, I mean, things have been going pretty good. The Arabian nations around there, the ungodly nations, hadn't bothered them too much. They tried to intimidate them, but hadn't bothered them too much. But now we're at the point where the wall's half built. Do you realize the halfway point in our efforts is Satan's temptation point and his opportunity? Because now the people have been working hard, they're tired, and they're still looking at the rubble at a half-built wall, and they're discouraged. And when you get discouraged, you lose commitment. And so now they're thinking, I don't know, what's the use? You know, we're not making any progress now. There's a loss of strength at the halfway point. You ever be there? Have you ever been there? And whatever you've been trying to do, and it's struggling, it's hard, it's difficult, and you're at half point, and all of a sudden you start to lose strength and lose vision. They'd lost vision for the overall project. Now, Nehemiah had given them a vision. This is God's will. He's behind us. He's working with the king, giving us all these support structures and all this kind of business, and protecting us, and issuing an edict, let us go ahead and build the walls up, and all that's going for us. God's with us. And they saw that vision. They understood the meaning of having those walls built and how it reflected a God that was powerful, all-powerful, and deserved respect. They saw that vision. But now they're looking at the rubble. When you look at the rubble, you lose sight of the vision. I remember Davis Park. I love those brothers. There's a good-sized church. That building had been there 20 years when they hired me. And when we first walked in the building, now if you've been to Davis Park in Modesto, you'll know that it's one of these circular type of things with all the classrooms on the side, and there's a hallway that goes around them. In the middle is the big auditorium and all that. And it was bigger than this one. And so when we first walked in, started walking around, the hallways around the side were dark, you know. And my wife, she's real keen to this kind of stuff. She says, no, it's like a mausoleum in here. And she's trying to think of what it would be like for somebody that's just visiting. It's so dark in there, you almost bump off the walls, you know. You can't hardly see where you're going. A little bit of an exaggeration, but it was a point made, you know. And so I hadn't been there but maybe 3 or 4 months. And I talked to the guy that was the caretaker and janitor, whatever you want to call him. They don't call him that anymore, by the way. I forgot what they call him now. But anyway, good guy. And he'd been there for a long time, been there since the building was built. I just asked him one time, I said, how come it's so dark in these hallways? Do we not get the kind of light fixtures, you know, that would light up the hallways and supposed to do their job? He said, well, I thought we did. I said, were you here when they built this building? He said, yes. Were you here when they put in the light fixtures? He said, yes. I said, would you do me a favor? He said, what? I said, would you bring a ladder tomorrow? Let's look at these things. So he brought a ladder the next day, walked up there, opened up the fixture. It had two sockets, only one light bulb. I thought, let's look at the rest of them. He went around the whole building, and every one of those fixtures had two sockets and one light bulb. I said, why do you suppose it happened? That's the way it is. He said, it was always that way. He said, I didn't know. I said, didn't you think about it being dark in here to check? No, I never thought about it. He said, maybe I thought about it early on. I thought, we'll get it fixed. But how many church buildings do you know that were in building projects that never totally finished the project? How many do you know? I've been involved in a couple of them. They never totally finished. They got to a certain point. It was looking pretty good. But the finishing touches, they didn't quite get there because they were tired and worn out and whatever, you know, not that important. One light bulb in a fixture that takes two, not that important. They'll get to it someday. But you see, someday they became accustomed to it. Someday, hey, like it's always been. What's the big deal? But visitors coming in there, they don't think that way. They're thinking, man, it's awful dark in this place. I mean, what's with these guys? But we don't think about what visitors think, do we? We think about something we've gotten used to. So then I leave there and I go back to Lakeview. We just built a building at Lakeview when I left, a building that'll seat about 1,000. And we had, it was very well built, and we had these tile, this tile roof, you know. Then we had these dirt berms along the sides where they would build, plant flowers and all that. And when I got there, the berms were gone, and there was these big black spotches, you know, on the side of the building all the way around where the berms had been. And so I asked one of the elders, I said, where did the berms go? He said, well, we had to take them down because kids were crawling up those dirt berms and getting on the tile and breaking the tiles, and we had to pay them to get it fixed. I said, did you ever think about the fact that once you got the roof fixed and took the berms down, that somehow you could paint the spots where the berms were? Because we see these pyramid types of spots there that were black. The rest of the building was kind of a mauve type, but they're all around there, you know? Well, we thought about it, you know, but we just didn't get to it. It was 8 years before they got to it. And they only got to it because I demanded it. Actually, I didn't demand it. You know what I did? Because that's too positional. Yeah. I talked to a couple of deacons. I said, do you like the way this thing looks? He said, no, we never did. I said, which one of you would like to buy the paint and paint it? The guy says, I'll do it in a minute. I said, let's come by tomorrow night and we'll do it in church and never know it. The next day, nobody said anything about it. Can you believe that? But and it was interesting at Davis Park because people were walking in the building and they saw this light in the hallways. They're thinking, am I in the same church, you know? But what it says is we reach a certain point when the job is not complete and we get kind of satisfied with it. And after a while, it becomes commonplace. That's always the way we did it. We did it, it didn't work. Or it's the way it's always been. And our sight is diminished. We lose strength. We lose vision at the halfway point. And it's a loss of confidence then. And then becomes a loss of security and a loss of hope. And at that point, the church at Lakeview had lost hope. And they'd gone down about 200 since I'd been gone. I'm not trying to put it on me per se. I'm just saying that's what happened to leadership. And from that time, for the next 15 years, we grew from about 250 up to about almost 500 because we changed the trajectory. We changed the thinking. We didn't let the halfway point stop us. And we can get caught up looking at the rubble in our church, the spiritual rubble in our church, okay? And then get discouraged, give up. I've had some of you tell me some things in terms of your congregations. And by the way, I'll be here after this whole thing is over with. If you want to spend some time talking to me about specific things, I'll be here. And I've seen, and some of the things you talked about the leaders, elders, leaders, preachers that were dictatorial and all that and kind of destroyed the church. And I can remember years ago we had a church in Tacoma called the Southside Church. It was a very healthy church, but the preacher kept putting down doctrinal truths. And finally, the eldership was embracing more denominationalism. And several of the members finally left there, and now that church is a denomination, not even in our fellowship. They came over to Lakeview. And I talked to them for a while, and one of them was an elder that had been an elder there. I said, what happened? He said, well, it just continued to deteriorate. But he said it was slowly. You know, it's kind of like the frog, the proverbial frog that's in the pan, the water's lukewarm, and somebody's turned the heat up, but he doesn't know the heat's being turned up. Okay? And eventually gets cooked. He said, that's the way it was. He said, they started doing things we know weren't quite right, but they weren't so far off that we could get too upset about it, but it kept happening and kept happening with the preacher and the elders, and next thing we know, baptism's not essential anymore. It just kind of hit us. I said, why didn't you pick up on that 20 years ago? Well, you see, they didn't have the spiritual perception to understand what was happening and to not look at small movements here to realize we are in a track, we're on a trajectory that eventually will destroy this church. We've got to do something. Well, I wasn't an elder or preacher. I don't care who you are. Stand up and say, we can't do this anymore. But the elders, I don't care who. As long as you're a member of God's church and you're a Christian, you have a responsibility, whether you're an elder or a preacher or what you are, to stand up and say, this has got to stop. And this is the biblical reason why. They never did that. And they lost the church. There's another church, another congregation in Seattle, same thing. Because they got comfortable with what was happening. And they no longer had the spiritual sensitivity to say, this has got to stop. See, Nehemiah could have stopped right then. And probably the people that were following wouldn't have blamed him. But you see, that's not kind of Nehemiah. That's not the kind of leader Nehemiah was. Effective leaders motivate people. Effective leaders rise above their circumstances. Effective leadership is different than management. It inspires. It develops. What time? I'm losing track of time. When does this end, this session? 15 minutes, okay. Okay. 15 or 20, somewhere there. Sometime today, anyway. Effective leadership empowers workers. See, if I'm a positional leader, I don't empower workers because that's not on my mind. That's not important to me. The institution's what is important to me. Empowering you as an individual, if I can empower you and that affects and builds up the institution, you see, then I'll empower you. That's why we've got churches today and have for some time looking for the best evangelist or preacher that's the most dynamic and is going to help build the church. We don't want to hire, if you're this size congregation, I'm not reflecting anything on this congregation. I'm just saying a lot of churches are in that 200 range, 150 range are thinking, you know, we need to get a preacher that's going to motivate these people. We need to get a preacher that's going to build this church up. We need to get a preacher that's going to really make the church hum and grow in the community. You may have a guy that's pretty effective and he's very biblical, but he just doesn't have quite that ability to really grow the church. So we're going to look for somebody like that. So everybody out there is looking for the dynamic preacher. How many are there available? Huh? Not too many. But that's this idea of a positional kind of leader that says we got to get the preacher to do the job for us. Because being a positional leader means I don't have to be the person to do the job. I just give directions. I give orders. It's a lot easier to be a positional leader. I don't have to be involved. I don't have to go through the pain and frustration and the responsibility and maybe the criticism of trying to build a church because that's what we hire the preacher for. We wonder why we're in some of the messes we're in because we're trying to look for a preacher that's going to save us. Because the institutions become more important than individuals in the church. And we've lost track of the fact that our job is to empower our members. That's what leaders do. And that's what he did. He talked to his people. He encouraged them. He got them back online again. And he told them, he said, do you expect this is going to be easy at first? You thought it was going to be something to be a piece of cake or something? God never sets us upon the path of least resistance. You ever notice that? He doesn't direct us on the path of least resistance. He wants us to go through resistance. Why? There's some biblical basic principle that says that as you suffer and struggle, you grow. Nobody grows that doesn't suffer and struggle. It just doesn't happen. So we're at that point now. Are we going to struggle and grow, or are we going to just kind of stand by the wayside and hope that somebody is going to rescue us? Somebody's going to help us. This story, I think, reflects the principle. One day, a man found a cocoon of a butterfly. The next day, a small opening appeared. He sat and watched the butterfly for several hours as it struggled to force its body through the little hole. Then it seemed to stop making any progress. It appeared as if it had gotten as far as it could, and it could go no farther. So the man decided to help the butterfly, and then it emerged easily. But it had a swollen body and small, shriveled wings. The man continued to watch the butterfly because he expected that At any moment, the wings would enlarge and expand to be able to support the body, which would contract in time. Neither happened. In fact, the butterfly spent the rest of its life crawling around with a swollen body and shriveled wings. It never was able to fly. What the man in his kindness and haste did not understand was that the restricting cocoon and the struggle required for the butterfly to get through the tiny opening were God's way of forcing fluid from the body of the butterfly into its wings so that it would be ready for flight once it achieved its freedom from the cocoon. Sometimes struggles are exactly what we need in our lives. If God allowed us to go through our life without any obstacles, it would cripple us. We would be weakened to the point we could never fly. Isn't that the way the world is? That's the way life is? But it's easier, isn't it, to not have to struggle. In this happiness-seeking world we're in now, it's more a happiness thing to avoid struggles, pain, suffering, whatever. Our whole goal as a society, and it creeps into the church, is to get that better job, to get that more comfortable house, to get that recreational vehicle, get this, that, and the other thing that makes us happy and we can enjoy life. And so everything is built around this idea of doing better for the point of being more comfortable. And all of the advancements as far as technology is concerned has to do with making people more comfortable and less having to do work that's unsavory and difficult. I can go back to the time when nobody on my block had a TV, but one guy. His dad had a TV with a big old box and a little old screen. Yeah. And when I finally got it, we finally got a little black and white TV, a little black Admiral. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. It had three channels. Went up to 10 o'clock and that was the end of it. But I thought that was fantastic. You know, now, you know, we talk about needs versus wants. There are some things I don't need, but there are some things I do need today. I need a microwave oven. I'm hitting home here now. And in Washington, you want a garage door opener, I'm telling you. Those are needs now because it rains up there, you see. And I don't want to get out of the car and get wet going in the house. Now, you know, we laugh at this kind of stuff, but it's happening. And what it does is it dumbs down our willingness and our effectiveness in going through struggles and strife to grow. And so in a church now, it becomes more easily just to go with the flow because it makes me happy and I don't have to struggle. And it's hard to fight that. That's exactly what the Chinese brethren were saying to Charles Cook. He understood after he left. It's hard to change that. That's what motivated me to write that happiness-seeking or that joy principle book, because you look at the Bible, it's totally different than what we're living today. The things that they went through in that first century church, it's amazing. And Paul says, expect it. Jesus said, expect it. To the point, it's said so many times by so many of the apostles and prophets and Jesus, you'd come away from the Bible thinking, man, if I'm not suffering, am I a Christian? And so Nehemiah said, I'm not going to let that slow me down here because it's God's will. And he empowered his workers. He could have chewed them out and preached a few sermons to them and told them they were dumb sheep. But he began to teach them what the vision really was all about. And that God doesn't send us on the road of least resistance. Any more thoughts about that before we close? Well, I'm in the third lesson, and I've only got 1 hour left on it. And I haven't started the third one yet. Okay, let's just open up for questions. I hope that if we don't get through all this stuff, you can read the book. How's that? That we're getting somewhere anyway. Yes. Of Nehemiah? Oh, I embellish a little bit. You'll have to give me some license there, but I guess it's on tape, isn't it? Is all this stuff on tape? You want to know which book is up? Okay, the Creating Biblical Leaders book is the book. Yeah, that one right there. Yeah. Now, if you want, if you want my embellishment, you'll have to get the tape. But most of that stuff's in the book, yes. See, by the time Nehemiah came along, the captivity didn't have quite the sting that it had when Babylon conquered Jerusalem. Yeah. They were living quite well, by the way. Most scholars say they were living pretty well. They were no longer slaves or what have you. They were people that were just, they were a Jewish nation that was respected. And of course, as Jews do, they got into the banking business, you know, and so they became powerful, see? And so the people needed them. So they had lost some of that sting of being a captured people. Yes, you had it. Yeah. The online and the church website. So, yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. See, the thing I like about Nehemiah is he pursued things. He didn't let the conventional wisdom control him. His brothers, see, went to Jerusalem. That's what started this whole thing. I don't know whether he would have been totally aware of what was going on, but his, you know, back in that day and time, they didn't have, you know, cell phones, okay, and iPads and all this kind of stuff. No satellites. So his brother goes back to Jerusalem, comes back and gives him the report. And I don't know how, you know, and back in those days, you could not, there's sometimes things you wouldn't probably know that that's far away, that's real far away, that you wouldn't know is going on. We don't have 24, we have 24/7 news now, but you didn't have anything like that back then. So he wasn't totally aware of the destruction, totally aware of the fact, because Ezra had gone back and Zerubbabel went back to be the governor. Perhaps he assumed everything's being taken care of. His brother comes back and said, nobody's doing anything about the walls. That's when he jumped on board. He saw the problem. He says, I will stick my neck out and get this thing done because I want to do it for God's purpose. Somebody else have a hand up? Yes. Thank you. Glad you're here. Thank you so much. Very much. This is my joy. I mean, I love my church. I love my eldership, but I love doing this. Otherwise, I mean, at 71 years old, I probably could have sat somewhere in a rocking chair under a leaf somewhere and somewhere, but I, you know, whatever. Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other thoughts or questions before we? Yes. Yeah, you know what the reason was? Well, it's kind of like discussing a peace plan with Iran today. How's that working for you? Can trust them folks, can't you? I mean, they're nice guys, you know. In fact, the president right now is trying to arrange, at least the vice president said that. I don't know whether you can trust him or what. But anyway, he's saying he's trying to arrange a peace talk with Iran. And they're laughing about it. Why? They don't. Because he knew that. He knew that they're out to trick him. He knew they were out to somehow destroy his reputation or whatever. He knew their motives were wrong, and he wasn't about to go. He's a wise man, and he understands the motives of his enemy. We don't understand sometimes the motive of our enemy. I don't know if we understand the motives of Satan sometimes, you see. But he understood the motives of his enemy. Good question. Any others? Yes, young man. Which one? All of them, all right. Well, I appreciate that. I like them all, too, to be honest with you. I try to keep this as biblical as possible. Appreciate that. I think we got about 4 or 5 minutes, so if you have a quick question, I won't get into this one right now. Okay, turn it over to you.